What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is Rabbi Mary Zamor, Executive Director of the Women's Rabbinic Network, the only organization of female rabbis in the world. We'll also have visits from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, our Maven on Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our new Maven on Jewish Education, John Ben Asher. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. It's the beginning of a new secular year, 2016, the year in which we'll elect a new American president. It's a good time to explore the concept of leadership, what it means, and what we should be looking for in someone we choose in this American election year. The Jewish model for the ideal leader is particularly instructive. In our tradition, the greatest leader of all was Moses, who brought our people from slavery to freedom, led us to Mount Sinai to receive the covenant of the Ten Commandments, united a group of unruly tribes into an organized nation, and shepherded the Israelites across the desert to the very borders of the Promised Land. Moses' path to leadership instructs us in qualities we Jews value in a leader, and he has a lot to teach us about who and what we might seek for our own nation today. First, Moses was a very reluctant chief executive. As the Torah describes in great detail in last week's Torah portion of Shemot, Moses was chosen by God to redeem the people of Israel from slavery, but he himself had no desire for the job. He understood the magnitude of the responsibility, and in the burning bush episode, he repeatedly objected to being selected for the task. Historically, American presidents were also officially reluctant to be chosen. As recently as the end of the 19th century, actively campaigning for the job was considered tawdry and inappropriate. That reticence has long disappeared from our national scene, of course, but a little consciousness of the humility that Moses showed would go a long way towards humanizing the folks running for president today. Moses was no Donald Trump or even Hillary Clinton. He took on responsibility rather than glorying in power and celebrity. Second, Moses had integrity and a deep inner faith that allowed him to overcome tremendous adversity. He knew what his mission was, and he stuck to it in spite of non-stop setbacks. Most of Moses' life was filled with failure. He fled his own country as a fugitive, became a humble shepherd in the desert, was initially rejected by his own people. The reason that 10 plagues were visited upon Egypt was because Moses' initial efforts at liberation all failed more than 10 times. And throughout his 40-plus year tenure as leader of the Israelites, Moses' judgment was unceasingly questioned publicly by nearly everyone he was supposed to be commanding. He even had to talk his own superior, God, down from destroying the people on a variety of occasions. That's a really tough position to be in. And yet Moses persisted in his course, overcame deep adversity, and ultimately triumphed. Integrity, faith, and commitment, key qualities in a leader. Finally, Moses had a remarkable ability to respond to failure with resilience and flexibility, to learn from mistakes and change for the better. He had to learn to be an effective administrator, how to delegate authority and responsibility, how to address criticism and ridicule effectively while keeping his eye on the main task. The ability to grow, change, and develop are all essential leadership qualities. I wonder how far a presidential candidate would get if he or she said, "I have a lot to learn about being commander-in-chief of a huge military machine, but I'll learn it and make certain our military is responding effectively in the best interests of our country and the world." Or if he or she said, "I don't have the solution to ISIS and worldwide Islamic terror, and nobody does right now, But here's how I'll learn to address these issues. I'll find a new, effective way. I think that any candidate would be crucified for saying those things, but that would be the truth. And Moses had an unflinching ability to face reality and speak the truth. Wouldn't we like to see that now in the presidential race? Frankly, if he were running, I'd vote for Moses ahead of any of our current presidential candidates. He's not, but perhaps we can insist our own presidential candidates adopt a more Moses-oriented approach. In celebration of the new secular year, I hope you are all still enjoying. And to play us in this morning, here's the wonderful Israeli-American singer Noah in duet with the great Italian tenor Andrea Bocelli singing Life is Beautiful, the theme song by Nicola Piovani for the remarkable Holocaust film of that name. The English lyrics are by Noah and Gil Dror.
Smile without a reason why. Love as if you were a child. Smile no matter what they tell you. Don't listen to a word they say, 'cause life is beautiful that way.
Blu, il cielo ancora blu. Tu coloralo di più. Vai in questa confusione, milioni di persone, il mondo è vuoto se non ci sei tu.
That was Israeli-American singer Noah, a past guest of Too Jewish, and Italian singer Andrea Bocelli singing Life is Beautiful, La Vita è Bella, in English, Italian, and Hebrew, recorded just last year. While women have been ordained rabbis since 1972, they still face different challenges than male rabbis. Find out what these are and explore the changes women have made in the Jewish world as rabbis with our guest, Rabbi Mary Zamor, Executive Director of the Women's Rabbinic Network, the only organization of women rabbis in the world. Meet her when we return in a few moments on Too Jewish.
Are you or a loved one facing a terminal illness? Casa de la Luz Hospice offers patients and loved ones the support necessary to face the final months of life. Paid for by Medicare and most private insurances, hospice team members provide medical, emotional, and spiritual care in the security and comfort of the patient's home. Casa de la Luz has been a leading provider of hospice care in Tucson since 1998, and today serves more patients in Pima County than any other local hospice provider. The mission of Casa de la Luz Hospice is to provide superior care to patients and their loved ones, so that they may complete their mission on this earth in comfort, dignity, and harmony. Call 544-9890 to learn more about how Casa de la Luz Hospice can help you. That's 544-9890. Casa de la Luz Hospice, because every day counts.
Hi, I'm Ben, a student at Tucson Hebrew Academy. Attention Arizona taxpayers, you can provide Jewish education to families at no cost to you. Direct your Arizona state tax dollars to JETCO, the Jewish Education Tax Credit Organization, and help make great Jewish education affordable. Here's how it works. Arizona lets taxpayers receive a dollar-for-dollar tax credit for payments made to JETCO. JETCO gives scholarships to kids who attend private schools like Anshe Israel's Kindergarten and Tucson Hebrew Academy, serving students from K-8. Tax credits are different from a tax deduction. When you give to JETCO, you get a 100% tax credit. That means your Arizona state income tax is reduced by the exact amount you've given. You can give up to $1,067 for a single filer and $2,134 for a married couple. You get that whole amount back from your state income tax. Give JETCO a call at 647-8442. That's 647-8442, or go to JETCO.org. You can even choose a future date to process your payment. How cool is that? Make a tax credit contribution to JETCO and build Jewish identity in Tucson for generations of students. And it won't cost you a dime.
We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Mary Zamora. She's the executive director of the Women's Rabbinic Network, a past guest of Two Jewish in another context. The Women's Rabbinic Network is the only organization of women rabbis in the world, and certainly the largest by definition. Good morning and welcome to Two Jewish.
Thank you. Good morning to you as well.
Mary, tell us about the original foundation of Women's Rabbinic Network.
Well, we started very organically, way before I was a rabbi. Of course, Sally Presand was the first woman rabbi in 1972, ordained by Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion. And it was a little bit of a lapse of a few years before the next ordination. And then there was a small trickle. And as the numbers grew, the women started to gather just to support one another. And they, over time, gave this informal meeting in living room, sitting in a circle, sometimes letting their children run around as toddlers in the middle of the circle, grow into an organization as there were more and more women rabbis and as they were facing challenges and sought out other women rabbis to help them through those challenges.
Now, there have been organizations of rabbis probably as long as there have been rabbis. Why was there, what's different, I guess I would say, about a women's rabbinic organization?
Well, it's our sole focus to really work on the issues that affect women rabbis and that are outgrowth of the issues that we face directly. So we're very involved with women's issues in general. For instance, this week at the RCA, the Rabbinical Council of America, reiterated their ban on Orthodox women rabbis, and through our leadership, we, with the support of the CCAR, Central Conference of American Rabbis, were able to make a statement in support of these amazing women scholars, leaders of the Jewish community, because we have that experience. We know.
You know, we had Sarah Hurwitz on Two Jewish not too long ago, who was the first rabbah ordained modern Orthodox woman. Those kinds of bans were not restricted to the Orthodox.
No. We like to talk about the fact that we just have 43 years of experience of dealing and navigating through the challenges of co-leadership. And we're still facing challenges. This many decades later, women rabbis are still facing challenges. But thank God we've made an amazing amount of progress in the liberal community. And so we hope we can share that with other women.
We will talk more about what those challenges are and the direction of the Women's Rabbinic Network with Rabbi Mary Zamora when we return here in a few moments on Two Jewish.
We welcome David and Pam of Freedom Smoke. Tell us about your product, Freedom Smoke.
Hello, Rabbi Kohan. A pleasure to be here again. Electronic cigarette industry has been around for years. Our product, one of the best things that we've done to improve it, is the base ingredients for our product are brought in from outside of this country. The only place in the world certified kosher.
Kosher, smokeless, no tobacco, and a variety of health advantages. Do you have a lot of former smokers that have kind of quit because of Freedom Smoke?
Absolutely. We have several people who have written to us as well as told us on a personal basis.
How many flavors are there of what you sell?
Over 700.
And when people walk in the store and they don't know what to do, what do you tell them?
We start them off by finding out what they smoke and how much they smoke. We then set them up with the nicotine level that's appropriate for them, and we find the correct flavor, and that's all that it takes.
How do people find your stores?
They can find us on the internet, of course, freedomsmokeusa.com. We have a toll-free number, 800-705-7013. Word of mouth is really good for our company, bringing people into our stores.
And it's kosher.
That's correct. Yep.
We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
Do you know someone who personally made a major difference for the whole Jewish people? An individual who's done important work for Klal Yisrael and deserves to be highly recognized for that effort. As president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, I'm grateful that the modest cash awards we started more than 10 years ago have grown into a substantial amount of unrestricted funds given to winners, with the help of donors like many of you. The foundation, named for my grandparents, Rabbi Samuel S. Kohan and A. Irma Kohan, makes these awards for important service to Klal Yisrael, the entire Jewish people. That service can be in one of four activities: unity, education, creative arts, or rescue. Past Kohan Award recipients are remarkable people who've done outstanding work. If you know someone who qualifies for a Kohan Foundation Award in 2016, please go to kohanaward.com, C-O-H-O-N-award.com, and fill out the simple nomination form. That website is kohanaward.com. Nominate an individual or donate yourself. Do it for the whole Jewish people. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's T-O-O Jewish Radio 18. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website by streaming them, or download us at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts. We have 10 months until we elect a new president of these United States. We continue our election year feature, the 2016 Two Jewish Presidential Report, as we choose the new leader for our nation. In the last election, almost 70% of Jews voted Democratic for president. But you would never guess it from the scale of the two parties' respective political operations targeting Jews. The head of the Republican Jewish Coalition, Matthew Brooks, is one of the top-paid CEOs in the whole Jewish world. But his Democratic counterpart doesn't even appear on the list of highest-earning heads of Jewish organizations because, for the first time, there is no one there. The National Jewish Democratic Council has cut all staff and outsourced its activities to a Washington, D.C. PR firm. The Republican Jewish Committee, on the other hand, operates on a budget of more than $3 million and employs 18 people in an expansive suite in downtown Washington. Matt Brooks, the executive director, himself earns about $600,000 a year from the Republican Jewish Committee. In 2015, the RJC summoned all the GOP's 2016 presidential candidates to multiple gatherings, which they competed to convince the group's wealthy donors to back them. The group is thriving, growing in resources and in presence. By contrast, the National Jewish Democratic Committee has no office at all. Its work is carried out by Blue Light Strategies, a PR firm that does work for many Democratic Party clients. In 2014, NJDC operated with a budget of less than $500,000. In the last 2 years, it's undergone a reorganization, and its budget now is even smaller. Our objective was never to compete with the RJC, said Greg Rosenbaum, the chair of the National Jewish Democratic Committee's board. He noted that Jewish voters who support the Republican cause can do so only through the RJC or by backing the sole GOP Jewish congressman, Lee Zeldin. Must be lonely. Democratic Jews can choose to back anyone among 28 Jewish Democratic members of Congress, both House and Senate. We're defending the high ground, so our expenses are lower, Rosenbaum explained. The NJDC's downsizing moved into full speed after the abrupt departure of Executive Director Rabbi Jack Moline about a year ago in December of 2014. He served for less than a year. Moline criticized the Democratic Party for failing to mobilize the Jewish vote in midterm elections in 2014 that resulted in a huge Republican victory. Frankly, it sounds like the Democratic Party is taking the Jewish vote very much for granted. That was our 2016 presidential election from a Jewish perspective update.
We welcome our Mivina in Israel, Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
And Shana Tova Lachilonim.
Shana Tova, Shana Ezrachit Tova, as we say in Hebrew.
Happy New Year, but it's not the Jewish New Year that we're celebrated.
We have four ones.
Yes, we have four Jewish New Years. None of them are December 31st, January 1st. But Israelis do have a holiday that they call, ironically, Sylvester. Most of us have no idea what that is, except like the cat and Tweety bird. So can you explain what Sylvester is all about?
Actually, Sylvester is the New Year's Eve. And I don't know if 90% of the Israeli, not to mention maybe 99%, doesn't know who Sylvester were, why we celebrate, why we gave him the honor of, you know, naming the New Year's Eve after him. And I don't know. I just heard one of the myths that, you know, the Orthodox in Israel say you don't need to celebrate Sylvester because he was a Jew hater.
Well, I I looked up in my deep Jewish sources, meaning Wikipedia, and
Rabbi Wikipedia,
the Rabbi Wikipedia. And, you know, it's sort of a Roman origin of a bishop, and it doesn't really make a lot of sense for Jews to celebrate it, but Israelis don't care about that. They celebrate Sylvester. That's their New Year's Eve. What does an Israeli, typical Israeli do on New Year's Eve, on Sylvester?
Usually, it depends how old you are. If you're old enough, so dinner and a movie. And if you're young enough, you go to a party, like a real party. Even when I was very young, I never went to a party.
That's, I believe that completely. Even in Beit Shean, they have parties?
No, but people, you know, will drive to, it's Haifa, Tel Aviv. I don't need to remind you that Israel is a tiny, tiny, like an hour and a half, you're in the other side of Israel.
I know. I was talking to a friend. They said he said there's never a reason to refuse to go to a wedding in Israel because you can go anywhere in the country except maybe a lot in what, an hour and a half. You know, like
definitely
less
can.
Maybe.
Can so with Kvish 6, it's even like the
new highway.
Route 6.
Yeah,
Route 6. It's even short and you know
even quicker.
Mamash.
So.
Yeah.
So in a way, it's not so much New Year's that's so interesting because really it's not so different what Israelis do from what Americans do, even if they call it Sylvester instead of New Year's Eve. But it's the fact that Israel is really in some ways like a large city, if you think about it. There's people, you can pretty much go anywhere and not very long.
Cities are like more neighborhoods.
And cities are like neighborhoods, so you know everybody.
Yeah.
Partly, even though there's, 7.5 million, almost 8 million Israelis now, that doesn't make it a big place. It has such a closeness to it.
It's almost like, you know, Phoenix and Tucson together.
Yeah, pretty much. And I think, actually, Israelis know each other better than people in Tucson know people in Phoenix.
Yeah. It's a nice topic to talk about it.
We'll come back. Thanks, Oshrat.
Toda Rabbi.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174. Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Gero Psychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Gero Psych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Gero Psychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Happy secular New Year.
And to you.
We've been talking about refugees. One of the really interesting situations in which refugees existed in a place for very different reasons on either side of a barrier that fell is the story of Berlin. Tell us that story.
Right. So I think everybody knows that long before the current bout of refugees, largely coming from the Syrian civil war and from unrest in Iraq and Afghanistan and other places in that region, there were a lot of Turkish basically economic refugees working as guest workers in what was then West Germany. And it was a huge percentage. And Turks followed up all kinds of opportunities. They became members of the German parliament. They became German citizens. They played a large role in the German economy and the political life of West Germany. They not surprisingly, Turkey being a NATO member, chose not to go to East Germany. But East Germany also had its share of refugees from other communist countries, which were dirt poor, like what was then North Vietnam or what was Laos and whatever. And these people largely settled in East Berlin and opened restaurants or laundries or whatever. So when Berlin was reunited after Germany was reunified, the authorities in Berlin set out upon a very creative sort of educational public morale campaign, which was very true to Berlin history. Berlin was always a very tolerant, cosmopolitan city in the 20s and 30s. It was really like the last place anybody expected Hitler to succeed because it was so liberal and left-wing and tolerant of all kinds of hippies and communists and whatever. So true to its own traditions and its own roots, the Berlin government, after Berlin was reunified, created this very clever poster campaign, and all the lampposts and kiosks and public spaces in Berlin were plastered with these posters, which asked questions in German such as, what means the phrase, in quotation marks, Berlin cooking? Or what means the phrase Berliner lifestyle? And the answer would be a series of this product from Vietnam with a Vietnamese food, like pho, showing, or this product from Turkey with kebab or whatever. And they were totally right, because Berliners, without thinking about it, every day ate and enjoyed and shared in the richness of all the cultures that had sort of invaded Berlin as refugees. And what the government was doing was saying, basically, don't treat these people as strangers and as different, because your lifestyle incorporates things they have brought you. They have enriched your lives. They have enriched our city. They have enriched our culture. And don't see them as other, with a capital O. And it was very successful. And Berlin remains an amazingly tolerant city of a huge number of minorities, which feel oppressed to one degree or another elsewhere in Europe and even elsewhere in Germany.
Fascinating. You know, really interesting about the possibility of opening people's eyes to what they're already experiencing in the diversity of the cultures. Thank you, Tom. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher, the head of Tucson Hebrew Academy. Boker Tov, John. Good morning.
Boker Tov.
And a happy secular new year.
2016, wow.
Hard to believe. Shocking, actually.
Shocking.
People think education in and of itself is a good, and it is.
Sure.
And that it's a kind of panacea for all of society's challenges. If everyone was educated, the world would be a great place. Yet the most educated population in the world in the 1930s was probably Germany, and it led to Nazi Germany. So education by itself can't be the sole answer.
Right. And I think it's about education with a soul, to turn that word around. It's all about making sure that as our youth grows up and learns about what's important, that they also receive a real strong moral guidance and framework for living, for making decisions, for interacting with other people.
Now, part of that happens at home, of course, from mom, dad, whatever the parental structure
right,
is, grandparents.
Right.
But part of that, is that a responsibility of a school?
You bet. And as educators, we like to say that parents are the first teachers of children. But then that changes quickly in life, and kids spend a third of their day with other adults who are responsible for their education. So schools have a critical role. I don't know that there's a panacea. We can't fix everything, but you certainly have to have a society that lays a strong moral foundation for its youth as they grow up, and school must play an essential role.
How does day school differ in the, I guess I would say, the breadth of moral instruction that's available, if that makes any sense?
Yeah, that's a great question. We have such a rich opportunity in a Jewish day school setting to tap into our history, our texts, our stories of how to live life, how to make good choices. And it's ironic because as a teacher, you think that you're going to have a strong influence on kids, and you do. But I remember that when I first started in the classroom as a public school teacher, I was told, you can't teach about values. You just have to teach the stuff, the content.
Reading, writing, arithmetic.
Yeah, keep your values at home. And that was real disappointing. Of course I did. And as a head of Jewish day school now, not only do I encourage that, but it's an essential part of the mission. Our job is to make sure that kids know right from wrong and have an understanding of compassion and have the skills and the toolkit to be able to act in a compassionate way and in a moral way in their lives.
And that you can draw on the incredible wealth of Jewish tradition to help support that.
Absolutely. From Torah, from Mishnah, Talmud, the sages, our oral traditions, even what we see today in Jewish life when we look at Jewish leaders of today.
Thanks, John. We will talk next week. And
thank you.
Happy New Year again.
Happy New Year.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
My name is John Ben Asher, and I'm the head of school at the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Tucson Hebrew Academy is a pluralistic kindergarten through eighth grade Jewish day school. We foster educational excellence through an interdisciplinary, integrated general studies and Judaic curriculum. We teach our students to apply Jewish values and learning to everyday life, enabling them to make their community and the world a better place. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supportive learning environment. From the early years through comprehensive high school prep, children thrive in THA's uniquely enriching educational community and culture. Our 41-year tradition of excellence continues to produce highly skilled, critical, and creative thinking students with a strong moral compass and deep understanding of Jewish identity, traditions, and values, well prepared for the challenges to come. Tucson Hebrew Academy, thaaz.org, 529-3888.
The Temple Emmanuel Pilgrimage Tour to Israel with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan, is going May 29th to June 9th, 2016. If you want to go on a fantastic journey to Israel, seeing it all from Tel Aviv to Haifa to Tzfat to the Sea of Galilee to amazing Jerusalem, please email tojewishradio18@gmail.com or call 520-327-4501 for more information and an itinerary. It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Shlomo and Ruth are celebrating their golden wedding anniversary, and the reporter from the Jewish newspaper interviews him on the secret of the longevity of his marriage. Well, it dates back to our honeymoon, says Shlomo. We went to the Grand Canyon, took a trip down to the bottom of the canyon on mules. We hadn't gone very far when Ruth's mule stumbled. She looked at the mule and quietly said, "That's once." We went a little farther. The mule stumbled again. Once more, Ruth looked him in the eyes and quietly said, "That's twice." We hadn't gone more than another half mile when the mule stumbled a third time. Ruth grabbed a revolver from her backpack and shot the mule dead. I started to protest over her treatment of the mule. Ruth looked at me and quietly said, "That's once." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well and stay alive. And now a word of Torah. This week we continue the truly greatest story ever told, the Exodus narrative of slavery, plague, and liberation. As this week's portion of Va'era begins, the Israelites are in Egyptian slavery. The mysterious figure of Moses has returned to free them from bondage. God brings about a series of plagues that traumatize the Egyptians and bedevil the Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Blood, frogs, lice, wild beasts, boils, and cattle disease serially afflict the land and its inhabitants. or at least the non-Israelite inhabitants. In next week's portion of Bo, four more plagues come. Hail, locust, darkness, all leading up to the climactic death scene of the slaying of the firstborn, and the Exodus, the great moment in which our ancestors are freed from slavery. The plagues are interesting in and of themselves. There are three sets of three plagues each, increasing in severity and complexity, every one designed to prove the power of the true God and the impotence of the pagan gods of Egypt. The Nile River was a principal deity of Egypt, as well as the source of its life and livelihood, and so for the first plague, God turns it to blood. There are frog gods in the Egyptian pantheon, and they are next turned into pests that infest homes and fields. The scarab is a sacred beetle to Egyptians, symbol of the pharaoh's power. Insects like it are used to torment the inhabitants, and so it goes. Sacred cows get diseases. The fertility of the Holy Land of Egypt itself is destroyed. Finally, even the great Ra, solar disk of the sacred sun itself, is blotted out for days. The plagues are a statement of theology. There's only one God. Those who adhere to other gods and use their own power to enslave others will be overthrown. The arrogant will be overcome, freedom guaranteed, and justice through the true God will triumph. It's a message that still has resonance today. Whenever we come to believe that evil is destined to reign, that those who enslave others will rule, that those who use control for malign purposes will flourish, we should reread this plagues narrative in Egypt. For at heart, this is a universe created by God for good. When we increase justice, we are simply doing the work for which we were made. When we return on To Jewish, our guest, Rabbi Mary Zamor, Executive Director of the Women's Rabbinic Network, only organization of women rabbis in the world, will explore the status of female rabbis more than four decades after the first one was ordained here in America. Hear about it when we return in just a moment on To Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursdays, my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life, 322-7035.
Are you or a loved one facing a terminal illness? Casa de la Luz Hospice offers patients and loved ones the support necessary to face the final months of life. Paid for by Medicare and most private insurances, hospice team members provide medical, emotional, and spiritual care in the security and comfort of the patient's home. Casa de la Luz has been a leading provider of hospice care in Tucson since 1998, and today serves more patients in Pima County than any other local hospice provider. The mission of Casa de la Luz Hospice is to provide superior care to patients and their loved ones so that they may complete their mission on this earth in comfort, dignity, and harmony. Call 544-9890 to learn more about how Casa de la Luz Hospice can help you. That's 544-9890. Casa de la Luz Hospice, because every day counts.
We continue with our Two Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
U.S. spying program scooped up communications between members of Congress and Israeli leaders, giving the White House insight into Israel's lobbying of U.S. lawmakers against the Iran nuclear deal. This was revealed by current and former U.S. officials last week. The U.S. continues to spy on select leaders of allied nations, despite President Barack Obama's pledge to curb such surveillance 2 years ago. It is a top priority, apparently, to maintain spying on Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu and his government. U.S. officials revealed that the NSA also monitored communication showing Israeli officials trying to turn American lawmakers against the international deal that curbed Iran's nuclear capabilities. One senior U.S. official described the discovery of the captured communication as an oh-shoot moment, and fears the executive branch will be accused of spying on Congress. Obama administration officials thought the information it uncovered could potentially counteract Bibi Netanyahu's crusade to stop the nuclear deal, which failed. But rather than make a formal request to the NSA for the back and forth, the White House allowed the NSA to decide on its own, without leaving a paper trail by submitting a formal request. "We didn't say do it," a senior U.S. official said. "We didn't say don't do it." Apparently, the NSA removed the names of the lawmakers and personal information, as well as trash talk about the White House before passing on the info. Officials say President Obama insisted that keeping tabs on Netanyahu served a compelling national security purpose. Obama alluded to an exception on spying for certain leaders, but didn't name any specific individuals in a speech. Behind closed doors, however, the White House agreed on which allied leaders would be exempt from surveillance, including French President François Hollande, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, and other NATO leaders. But the U.S. administration still allowed the NSA to target these leaders' advisors, as well as other allies, including Turkish President Erdogan. Everyone concerned has declined to be quoted by name, of course. This is an ugly story. It makes the long detention of Jonathan Pollard for spying on America for Israel an even more obvious miscarriage of justice. Everyone does it. Pollard was recently released after serving 30 years in U.S. federal prison. So we continue to spy on our allies, especially Israel, and the NSA targeted Bibi Netanyahu and the congressmen and women who interact with Israel. Nice way to treat friends. And elected officials of Congress, our own national government, were spied on by the NSA, apparently. This story will not go away quickly, I expect. In other news, back in September, the Reconstructionist movement adopted a controversial policy. It publicly stated it would ordain students in its rabbinical seminary as rabbis who were in interfaith relationships, including interfaith marriages. Now, the first signs of discontent are beginning to appear as a Florida congregation prepares to vote January 18th on dropping out of the movement because of the decision. "It was the last straw," said Arlo Binderman, a member of Congregation Kol HaNeshamah in Sarasota, Florida, and a supporter of the resolution to part ways with the Reconstructionist movement. "The movement used to be a little left of conservative. Now it has become way left of Reform Judaism." The decision to allow intermarried clergy set Reconstructionist Judaism apart from all other major Jewish denominations and drew immediate criticism. So far, however, the Sarasota Synagogue is the only congregation to take steps towards seceding from Reconstructionism, which is already Judaism's smallest major movement. Josh Peskin, Vice President of Strategic Advancement at the Jewish Reconstructionist Communities, declined to provide information regarding the number of synagogues currently debating their future with the movement. He said the organization continues to work with Reconstructionist congregations to help address questions and concerns regarding the non-Jewish partner decision. "We will see just how far from Judaism our American Jewish movements can go before they stop being, you know, Jewish." And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world.
We welcome back to Two Jewish, our guest this morning, Rabbi Mary Zamora. She is the executive director of the Women's Rabbinic Network, the not only largest organization of women rabbis in the world, but still the only organization of women rabbis in the world. Funny question. There have been conservative women rabbis since the 1980s. They don't have a separate organization?
Not that we know of. They certainly have done a great deal of organizing and leadership, but really task-driven. They don't have a formal organization that has an ongoing mission. We, as an affiliate group of the Central Conference of American Rabbis, have this unique role. And really, we have such a large number of women rabbis that that we have a lot of resources to be able to do this and to have an organization that stands alone like this.
And before we explore some of those issues, this must be the only Jewish organization that hasn't yet been founded. When you think about the plethora of organizations we seem to have, it must have been a process for the Women's Rabbinic Network to be recognized by the Central Conference of American Rabbis, which, as much as, you know, are both of our organization as well, doesn't mean it changed quickly. Can you talk about that process a little bit? Because I'm not sure that it was immediately recognized and accepted.
Well, I don't know if it was immediately looking for recognition. You know, we have truly evolved over, we're in our fifth decade of being an organization, of having women rabbis. And really, as I said before, it started so organically, of just women reaching out to one another as students, then as ordained rabbis, trying to navigate their way through seminary, navigate their way through placement, through careers, and to be able to hold one another up and support one another in a way that they weren't finding in the rest of the Reform community, frankly.
So when we were in school together, about mm-hmm. half of our class were women.
Mm-hmm.
In some of the classes that have been ordained subsequently, the majority of the candidates who have achieved ordination have been women. It's not an unusual experience. What is unique now about the role of a woman rabbi when, you know, we can make a case that in not very long, half the congregational rabbis in the Reform rabbinate will be women?
Absolutely. So even within the Central Conference of American Rabbis, within our affiliate organization, we've had women presidents now of the organization. There are wonderful women leaders within the professional staff of the organization. Women are very active as leaders within that organization. So what makes WRN unique in its goals and mission, and what we support, mm-hmm. the way we support, is that women are still facing unique challenges in terms of, first of all, pay equity. In 2013, the CCAR, in support with the WRN, released data showing that women rabbis make somewhere between 75 cents to 77 cents on every dollar a man makes.
Kind of a financial glass ceiling in a way.
Well, certainly a financial...
An inequity, for sure.
Inequity and bias. Mm-hmm. While there are women who have broken glass ceilings, and there are more and more every year, we still see that the candidates for larger size congregations, really medium and up, are still skewed more towards men. And we can examine that in many, many ways to try to see the root of that. That women still face a great deal of challenge for maternity leave, navigating work-family balance, navigating the unique types of rabbinates that are not only for women, but certainly are heavily more with the women rabbis than with the male rabbis. We were also talking a great deal about subconscious bias. One of the things I find very interesting, as women are making these wonderful steps forward, you know, after all these decades, you still hear a shift in language when people talk about women rabbis. You'll hear, it's very subtle, but she's so good with the children. She's so good at teaching, at pastoral work. They don't talk, and really it's unfair to men too, if you think about it. Men can be equally as pastoral, as good with children, but these are the elements that people talk about women.
So there's sort of a gender stereotyping that goes on among congregations, among the rabbis themselves?
I think all of the above. I think that it's only a reflection of our society. And so really we want people to be able to look at every rabbi as a unique person, to have equal opportunity, equal pay, and to be able to shape his or her rabbinate in a way that works best for them.
What issues has WRN identified that are the hottest button issues right now for the Women's Rabbinic Network mm-hmm. in the current year?
So right now, I just started July 1st. In October, we had a
By the way, Mazel Tov. I should have started with
thank
that.
Thank you. No, that's okay.
Exciting new position for you.
It is. It is a passion, and I'm very blessed to be doing it. We had our board retreat in October, so we're very focused on exactly what we're doing right now. So the number one thing, which we've made wonderful progress on, is right now the smicha document, the document almost like the graduation type. Well,
the ordination certificate for every rabbi.
That we receive through Hebrew Union College, Jewish Institute of Religion, has not been equal in language until now. For the last 43 years. When Rabbi Presend was ordained, there was a lot of controversy about what they should put on that document. I have an article coming out in the CCAR Press's upcoming book, The Sacred Calling, that will shows all the archival evidence and examines the roots of this. But the basic answer is that the language is not the same. Your document and my document, even though we're classmates, say different things in terms of the actual Hebrew declaration of being a rabbi.
Rabbi, this is the first time I ever heard that. That's fascinating.
Rabbi Aaron Pankin.
A former guest of Two Jewish and the president of HUCJAR, College Jewish Institute of Religion,
has tasked Rabbi Michael Marmer, and he's convening a faculty committee, and I'm going to be ex officio member of that committee, as I've been petitioning the college to make this change, and they, of course, want to do this, and that's exciting to be able to say now ordination is 100% equal.
Truly egalitarian.
Truly, and that's kind of low-hanging fruit, obviously. But it's symbolic and it's important. The other thing we're doing a great deal of work with here at this biennial, we have been partnering with the Women of Reformed Judaism. Some people call that sisterhood. That's the new name. That we've been doing work with pay equity and with family and parental leave. And we're going to be continuing to hunker down on those issues in the coming year. We very much want to help educate the URJ congregations in the Reform world why they should care about parental leave, family leave, how they should go about it, and what standard they should be trying to reach for.
So along those lines, is there a standard that the WRN recommends for parental leave, both maternity and paternity leave?
Absolutely. A minimum of 12 weeks. Minimum. Paid weeks. And that's really the catch. And pay equity, of course, is another huge thing for us.
How do you pursue pay equity? That's an interesting question, isn't it?
It is. And one of the things that we're trying to do is open a great deal of dialogue about that issue. Because unless we're able to talk about it honestly, we're not going to come up with a solution. So in part, we're doing a listening tour right now, talking about the issue, educating people about the issue. I think it's really important that congregations and Jewish organizations do a sense of cheshbon ha-nefesh, self-reflection, before they do any kind of hiring, any kind of evaluation, or any type of contract with their employees, and that they really think about the subconscious bias. A lot of corporations now do this. A lot of universities do this. They have to do online training to think about subconscious bias before they engage in those actions, and to be aware of their own self-conscious bias before they give someone a contract or offer them a job. The other thing that we can do again is we're going to have to see exactly where we go with this, but we may go to a campaign of inviting congregations to sign a brit. To ask them to sign a covenant
contract
that they have educated themselves, thought about this, and are striving to do better.
Fascinating. I want to thank Mary Zamor for a great visit here on Two Jewish. Where can people go to find out more about the Women's Rabbinic Network?
Absolutely. They can find us at the Women's Rabbinic Network.org at our website. And we very much would like people to keep apprised of what we're doing and to support us.
And to find out about the only organization of women rabbis in the world, not to mention by far the largest. Mary, thanks again.
Thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical playoff.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9. Our guest will be comedian Joel Chesnoff, a favorite. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish comes from an Orthodox group called Eighth Day. It's a tune called Celebrate, based on Shir HaMaalot, the psalm. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
Here we go now, here we go again. Oh, ye knew a eunuch a whole name. It's like you're sleeping, sleeping. There's a smile deep, deep within you. Ushaneinu, Rina, Rina. This song's for singing, Rina. Shira Malois, Vishu Vashem.